councils are changed almost every year. The consequence is that as practically the entire land is divided amongst the cities, each of them requires its bishop to live in the cities, and scarcely any noble or great man can be found in all the surrounding territory who does not acknowledge the authority of a city. And from this power to force all lands together, they are wont to call the several lands of each their cantado. That's the land around the city that they control. Also, that they may not lack the means of subduing their neighbors, they do not disdain to give the girdle of knighthood or the grades of distinction to young men of inferior status, and even to some workers of the vile mechanical arts, whom other people bar like the plague from the more respected and honorable pursuits. From this it has resulted that they have far surpassed all other states of the world in riches and power. He seems very critical, doesn't he, until he gets to the end, but they're richer than anyone else, and they're more powerful than anyone else. So what do you notice here? Actually, what we have is a clash of civilizations, kind of. What do we have going on? Yes?
Well, the transgression of the class or the caste system, where you're allowing commoners to be called royalty so that you'll balance out that.
He's come from a world of knights and vassals, mm-hmm. and then knights who have serfs working their manors, right? And what does he find here?
So you can work your way up.
And you can be a knight if you're a merchant. These cities had citizen militia. So we have something that's entirely at odds with the feudal manorial system of the north. And he doesn't understand it. The land is divided between cities. The nobility recognize the authority of the city, which he finds really amazing. And he sees these citizen militias, which allow common people to be knights, to fight. It's clear that by the time they came over the Alps in 1149, the cities of Italy had evolved from a form of political life entirely at odds with the prevailing assumption that hereditary monarchy or empire constituted the only sound form of government. He goes on to scold the Italians for not recognizing their true lord, the emperor. I just can't believe how insolent they are.
So he's doing some 1149?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually what happens is Barbarossa tries to subdue the cities of northern Italy. Does he ever do it, David? Does he ever subdue those northern cities? No. No, they form the Lombard League. He defeats them once, but they come back again and defeat him. So the emperor is always trying to control these cities.
Some of these things in here that he's talking about in terms of the things that he sees that are wrong are the same things that Bruni points out as a strength.
Yeah. Yes, and I think this last part of this quote here is interesting too. He criticizes them, and yet he has to admit they're powerful. They're rich. The Germans saw northern Italy as a garden of delights. Also elsewhere in this quote, he talks about their refined manners that they received from their Roman ancestors. So it's attractive, it's powerful, it's beautiful, but it's very alien to them. So by about 1150, the communes, what they're called in, I'm just going to kind of make this my rolling board here, if that's okay. Comune in Italian, or English communes, which really was a voluntary association for the common good. These communes, by 1150, were established in all the major towns and cities in Lombardy and Tuscany. Do you know what I mean by Lombardy? It's the area along the Po River, just south of the Alps, and Tuscany a little further south. Despite differing local circumstances and variations in terminology, most communes are remarkably similar in the phasing of their institutional development and the character of their political structure. They all set up regular assemblies of citizens to discuss matters of common concern. We don't think about this as a medieval political structure, but it's going strong in Italy. They all elected officers to run the commune. And as he points out, many of these had term limits so that they couldn't entrench themselves and build power bases, but they had to move on so that things would be kept even and peaceful. And all began producing statutes or legislating laws for themselves. Legislating for themselves, creating their own laws. For most of the later Middle Ages, communes found themselves in a precarious political position between an aggressive empire to the north and increasingly militant papacy to the south. This is important to understand their history. Okay, this is kind of a schematic picture, but you see the Holy Roman Empire based in Germany, this Kingdom of Italy, which they wanted to claim, but which didn't want to be claimed. Then we have the Papal States here. And by the 12th century into the 13th century, the papacy has actually gotten a lot of temporal power and is challenging the powers of the popes. So the city-states are caught right in between, which puts a lot of pressure on them. The papacy doesn't want the empire to come down that close to the papal states. They like to preserve the buffer. And so the empire, this is really the cause of a lot of conflict between the papacy and the empire, and these city-states are caught in between. Okay, but you have to understand that to understand the political development. After 1200, the growth of cities and the economy led to the growth of middling merchants, skilled artisans, and members of the legal profession and the notarial profession. So I don't want to say a middle class, but kind of there were merchants, skilled artisans, and notaries. A lot of them were notaries. Do you know what a notary is? You talked about that in here? Okay, good. And how important they were? Okay, good. And these social and economic classes organized themselves through guilds and created their own militias that were raised from different parts of the city. A guild, craft guilds, and they would, and then they would also organize militias drawn from different districts of the city. And they achieved for themselves a constitutional role in the commune, but not without conflict. Of course, the wealthy, you do have a kind of feudal nobility who are based in the country, but there's definitely a bridge to the city, so they would have large houses in the city, and those we call the magnates. The great landholding nobility, of course, wanted to dominate the cities, but we have the popolo, who are the common people, or the popolani, organizing themselves in guilds and challenging the power of the magnates. Okay, for more, I guess we could say democratic, although it's not really democratic, more representative, more broadly based representative government. So popular participation was followed by about the 1250s, middle of the 13th century, by the establishment of governments that were directly controlled by the popolani. Examples. In Florence, what became known as the Primo Popolo, the first popular government, was organized in 1250. And Florence would have a succession of other popular governments. The Popolo would remain in power longer or for longer periods of time in Florence than just about anywhere else, and that's why this political thought emanates from Florence, because it's still a broad-based guild government. Often it changes, but longer than others. Piacenza, which is in northern it's kind of over there by Milan, 1250. Lucca in Tuscany, 1250. Siena had a government of the Popolo by 1253. Bologna by 1255. Genoa by 1257. I'm just giving you an idea of how pervasive this was. By about the middle of the 13th century, these cities were ruled by popular governments. And as evidence of the growing public power, we have these communal palaces and beautiful public spaces that we love to take pictures of in these cities. That's what makes the city so charming. Florence, Perugia, Cremona, city after city. And I'm just going to briefly, I didn't want to go nuts and show too many, but they begin to build communal palaces or city halls. And this is one this is in Cremona. This is an early one. And it actually sits across from the cathedral, because it's an earlier one. They built them right there in the ecclesiastical center of the city, right across from the cathedral. Isn't that a beautiful building? That's a very early one. Here's another one from Piacenza, another beautiful medieval building from 1280, a city hall, or a Palazzo del Comune. And has anyone been to Siena? Beautiful, isn't it? And the Palazzo Pubblico in Siena and the piazza in front of it, carefully planned by the city, so all the architecture and the windows were all the same, and they chose the site very carefully. Inside are some very famous frescoes about good government and bad government and the need for justice and equity. And that tower, too, is very significant because the magnates would dominate their neighborhoods with towers. They would get in their towers with crossbows and rocks and fight each other. And so the popular governments would pull down the towers, and then here they built the biggest one you could find in town on their own public palace. Okay, kind of declaring public power, not private power, of the magnates. Okay, oh, and then of course the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence is a medieval communal palace. So when the Popolo asserted itself in the middle of the 13th century, it lacked a political tradition. They had to justify themselves somewhere. And what's out there floating around in intellectual circles, in medieval political theory, it's mostly concerned with the universal powers of empire and papacy. That was well understood. That was well documented. That was accepted. And the nature of monarchy. But there was no intellectual framework for popular movements. So they had a couple of options. What could they do? They've got to justify their existence. They've got to find great theories, but it's all kind of centering around monarchy and empire or kind of monarchical papacy. So what can they do? Huh?
Create one.
Back to a former time.
Okay. They can take the old authorities and interpret them in new ways, or they can come up with something new, entirely different. So now we're going to look at both of these options and see what these thinkers in Italy did. If you'll take your little Ptolemy of Lucca, he lived from 1227 to 13... Well, no, he didn't live that long. I've got my dates wrong. He studied in Paris in the 1260s, and he knew Thomas Aquinas. And Aquinas started a book called The Rule of Princes, and Ptolemy finished it. But he took a little twist. Aquinas begins his treatise by comparing regal and tyrannical government. That's how he outlines the choices, a regal versus a tyrannical rule, with tyranny being the worst and hereditary monarchy being the best. Just peruse down just the first couple of lines. How does Ptolemy divide, how does he define the two kinds of government? Remember, Aquinas says monarchical and tyrannical.
Political and despotic.
Political and despotic. What do you think he means by political? Yeah, who's he quoting?
Aristotle.
And what was Aristotle writing about?
Politics.
In city-states. He was not writing about monarchies, okay? So all these scholastic scholars have been reading Aristotle and talking about monarchy, but Aristotle was talking about city-states. Yeah. And so Ptolemy looks at Aristotle through the lens of a person who lives in a commune, who lives in a city-state. So what does he decide? So if there's political and despotic, what happens to monarchy? Which side of the ledger does monarchy go on?
Probably on the despotic side.
It's despotic. So he's kind of flipped Aquinas on his side, hasn't he? Okay? All right. The political and the despotic. So how does he describe political government? A couple of characteristics.
One or more men.
Okay. Right. Because what's he thinking of? He's thinking of the commune. And some of these, they start with consuls, and then they go to the podestà, which was actually like a hired one-year official who was one man who would lead the army. And come. So, you know, he could be thinking of one man in that sense, but he's still working with a council and consuls. So they rule in accordance with what? Their own statutes. So they make their own laws. As occurs, and where does he find this type of political government? He names two places you find it.
Rome.
As occurs in the regions of Italy, and as particularly occurred in Rome. So he's talking about ancient, and then he goes on, which was ruled by senators and consuls. Is that imperial Rome? That's republican Rome. Okay, so this is like a really early reference, and it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? He would look there for precedent. Okay, what does he say? Which is ruled by senators and consuls for the greater part of its history after the city was founded, and why in a political lordship there are two reasons why the subjects cannot be so rigorously controlled as in a regal lordship. What makes political lordship not as harsh, not as despotic?
Because they have term limits.
They're temporary, and that's what they did with those communal officers. They limited their terms.
And they work for salaries. So they work for money, so they don't really care. They're kind of there partly for the money and partly for the good of the people.
Right. They're hired, and when they leave, as soon as the books are in order and no one has any complaints against them, then they can leave town and they'll take a job somewhere else as a professional administrator. Let's see. So he argues when payment is provided, rulers give less zealous attention to the governing of their subjects, and consequently the rigor of their discipline is moderated. And we assume here that's a good thing, right? The second reason why political lordship is necessarily moderate, an exercise of moderation, concerns the subjects. And what does he argue? There's always a little bit of this nationalism in these writers. What's he saying about Romans? Nobody dominates Romans, right?
Oh, and of course they're Roman.
They're less easily brought to
subjection. They're less easily brought to subjection, right? Hey, all the Italians are Romans, right? Also, because they've been free of lordship, or because they've had experience of governing one another in turn, they're bold for liberty and willing to bow their necks to rulers. Thus, political lordship is necessarily gentle. Furthermore, this form of ruling is in accordance with the form of the communal and municipal laws by which the ruler is bound. Because the prince is not free, his discretion is eliminated and less like the divine providence. That's a pretty bold statement. He will argue further, Ptolemy will, that, he identifies monarchy with despotism and characterizes it as a form appropriate for slaves and brutish men who need to be coerced. But by contrast, free civilized people merit republican government, which permits them to make laws, the laws that they have to obey. So, Ptolemy and some others will hint that there was another Rome. There was a republican Rome, not just an imperial Rome. Do you have any questions about that little, just little adventure into the thought of Ptolemy of Lucca? There's a lot more, but yes.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, especially as Ptolemy here is rereading, in a sense, Aristotle, where's Athens in all this? And I had to ask myself this with Rumi, too, who's writing panegyrics about Florence, and this is based pretty much on the panegyric to Athens. Why are people looking back to Athens?
Why, well,
is it just the geographical? They're close to Rome. They can trace their lineage.
Why aren't they looking to Athens?
Because
they don't know Greek. Bruni is one of the first. Well, Petrarch really didn't know Greek. Salutati and Bruni. Florence brings a Greek scholar in to teach Greek. And so before that, Ptolemy doesn't know Greek. What they know of Aristotle has been translated. They're reading Aristotle in translation. I think that's the main reason, wouldn't you say? They don't really know Greek. But Bruni does, and he read Aristides in the original, and so he's going that direction with it. Is that?
Well, it seems odd that they'd be reading Aristotle.
Well, how do they get?
Not be cognizant of Athens, that didn't seem to quite connect with me, even if they were Greek.
Why do you think Rome looms so large in the medieval
mind?
Well, I think
they had a huge empire. I mean,
and the
church.
The
legacy of Rome is
the church.
Huge.
Yeah, I think it's really Rome that dominates in medieval thought. And I think it's really not till they really start to read Greek again that they come to appreciate. Yes?
Couldn't you also say it's because like even the thing we were reading today, you can trace your lineage back to Rome.
The Italians, definitely. That's what they're all about. They are Romans, yes.
Well, also, the Roman Republic did more than the Athenian Republic.
Yeah, the Athenians... And
they actually conquered Carthage. They never...
The Athenians never could pull an empire off. Remember just the Peloponnesian War and that fiasco? And it's Republican Rome that actually starts the empire going. They acquire empire as a republic. So, yeah, that's the other problem with Athens. And the Florentines will look to Republican Rome as empire builders to justify their own aggression, too. So was there another hand or another question?
Well, you know, even though... I'm sorry.
Yes, I want to worry about you. But
I worry about me all the time, too. But
okay, any other questions or comments? Okay. Are you guys still awake? All right. Just a little touch on another really interesting Florentine thinker. And that's his name is Remigio de Girolami. Did I say there's his name right there? Remigio de Girolami. He's interesting. He was a Dominican who lived from 1235 to 1319. He also studied at Paris and probably heard Aquinas lecture there. And he perhaps was a teacher of Dante. But he also applied Aristotle to the political realities of Florence. And in this little discourse, he again looks at Aristotle through the lens of a city-state. And this is just one little excerpt, which I think is kind of amazing. He says, when the citizen's city is destroyed, he's arguing for why citizens have to put the common good before their personal interest, why that's necessary. He said, when his city is destroyed, there remains only a stone or a painted citizen. Well, he means it looks like a citizen, but it's not a real citizen, okay, because it doesn't work. So, since he lacks the power to function as he had before, for example, a soldier in military matters, sorry, I dropped the R, a merchant in commercial matters, a guildsman in the activities of his guild. Do you understand what he's saying? Without a city, a guildsman can't be a guildsman. An official in official matters, a father in familiar matters, and generally, a free man cannot function in the activities proper to free men, for example, to go to one's farm, to make embassies, and to have power over other cities. And if he is not a citizen, he is not a man, since man is naturally a civic animal, according to the philosopher. Who's the philosopher?
Aristotle.
Okay, that's for the Middle Ages, that's a pretty amazing statement. So without a city, this is why it's so important for citizens to put aside their differences and to submit to the common good, because if your city's destroyed, you are not a man, because you can't function in any capacity. So that's just a little bit. There's a lot of interesting theory, a lot of interesting things written about Remigio de Girolami. So we can look at Aristotle again, or what was the second thing we can do? I think you mentioned it. What can we do if we need... We need a political tradition. We can kind of reinterpret the old stuff, or we can
make a new one.
Come up with something new. And the most amazing medieval thinker. Whoops! No, I've got to go back. I didn't put this up there. I'm just going to tell you about him. One of the most amazing new theories came from a guy by the name of Marsilius of Padua. Marsilius of Padua. He was a lawyer, and he lived from about 1275 to about 1342. And he was a lawyer. He's from Padua, which is a big university town. He was initially educated there locally, and then he went to Paris where he taught and finally became rector of the University of Paris in 1312. Paris was the queen of universities. It was the intellectual center of Europe. So he became rector there at the University of Paris, but he didn't forget his communal roots. In 1324, he wrote one of the most interesting and controversial political tracts of the age. In 1324, it's called The Defender of Peace. And I've got to tell you, it was part of an anti-papal, pro-imperial polemic. He was writing this in behalf of Louis of Bavaria, who was in a fight with the Pope. Okay, but he was probably the greatest medieval theorist of popular government. He believed, one, and think how modern this is, that the ultimate legislative and coercive power of government, the power to make law and the power to enforce law, resides in the whole body of the citizens. It could be delegated to a ruler, but never alienated. So power resides always in the whole body of citizens. It can be delegated, but never alienated. All rulers, because they're just powers are delegated, they're subject to law. And, of course, he'll throw in that no coercive power could be exercised by the Pope. Of course, he'll deny any kind of temporal power to the Pope. And he argued that if rulers and citizens upheld these principles, they could ensure the peace. That's what the defender of the peace is. He said, if you want peace in northern Italy, again, it's torn by these papal imperial conflicts. If you want peace in northern Italy, you need to understand that coercive and legislative power resides in the people. It's only delegated to leaders, can never be alienated. You have to understand that leaders are subject to the law and that the Pope can't have coercive powers. Pretty amazing theory of popular government. I don't think we'll hear anything else, you know, nearly as bold until way after the Renaissance. But yet we hear no... He gives no clear pronouncement on the relative values of monarchy versus republican government. So it's not really focused on that issue. As again, I said, it's more of a polemic against the papacy. So we have these, we have old wine in new bottles, and actually we have new wine in new bottles, and we have new wine in old bottles, right? So look at the old stuff. There is another option that begins to be available with the growing interest in Latin literature and history, with the growth of humanism. We have another option, another way to defend the Republican communal experience. And, in fact, Ronald Witt, have you guys ever heard of Ronald Witt? I'm sure you have. He's a Renaissance scholar. He teaches at Duke, and he's, you know, one of the heavyweights. He's just come out with a book that actually locates the beginning of humanism in Padua. Why Padua? Yeah, because there are what we call proto-humanists. Some people, he would say, this is humanism. Notaries in Padua are interested in classical forms of history, and there's one who's interested in classical forms of drama. And his name is Albertino Musato. Have you heard of him? Okay. Do you know what he did? Did you talk much about him?
Okay. I just heard the name.
Okay, Albert, he's a really interesting guy. Is it okay if I just keep erasing this here? Okay. Two S's? Okay. Ronald Witt will say he's actually the second generation, that there was a poet, Lobato, who was even ahead of him. But Albertino Musato, and he wrote a play. He also wrote a history that was very classical in its form. But he wrote a play called The Echarenus. It was kind of an interesting play. It's a weird name, isn't it? It's named after a tyrant who tried to subject the commune of Padua to his power. And his name was Enzolino da Romano. The Romano family was powerful in the area of Padua. He became imperial vicar of Frederick II when he was trying to conquer these towns. And so he, for a while, he did dominate Padua and suppressed the commune, and he was a tyrant, of course, according to the chronicles and according to Albertino. And Enzolino died, though, in 1256, and Musato wrote this in about 1315. I want to tell you a little bit about this drama. In it, he denounced the rule of this tyrant, but he's writing it just as another tyrant is threatening the commune. Congran della Scala. I don't know if you need to remember his name, but he was another prince who actually was able to subject a lot of cities around Padua. So as Padua's looking on at the growing power of Can Gran della Scala, Musato wants to write something to warn the commune. So he turns to a play written by Seneca. It's actually pseudo-Seneca. It's probably written under the Flavians. But he finds this play, and he basically rewrites it about the commune of Padua. So it's written in verse, classic, very consciously classical in its meter and its language. And the play, the original play by, I'll say Seneca, but they know it's not Seneca. It's the only historical Roman play that exists. And it was a very important influence on Shakespeare and his historical plays. But it's the story of the Emperor Nero. So Penzolino equals Nero. That's not too bad. And the play is called Octavia. So this is Seneca's Octavia. He does his own little version of it. And just to give you an idea of what he does, it's kind of interesting. Enzolino da Romano replaces the insanely evil Emperor Nero. Right? You guys know how evil he was. At least what the historians tell us. The people of Padua are his abused and suffering wife, Octavia, basically. He abuses, he imprisons, he mistreats these people of Padua that he has conquered. There's even a scene in the play where Seneca comes in to Nero and tries to talk him out of divorcing Octavia and killing her. But this time he has a Franciscan friar come in and talk to Enzolino about stop being such a tyrant and free this city. So it's really interesting how he takes this classical model and kind of reinterprets it into medieval Italy. So Seneca comes to talk some Stoic sense into Nero, and Musato has his friar Luca come and warn Enzolino of his eternal damnation if he keeps it up as a tyrant. And it's kind of erudite, and a lot of scholars wonder if he even hit the target with his audience because it's so refined, but he was crowned poet laureate by the commune in 1314, and the commune passed the statute that it had to be read aloud every year before all the assembled citizens. So they must have liked the idea. Okay, that's kind of interesting. Can we call this civic humanism? There are certainly some elements there. He's not really looking at republicanism as a model, but he's certainly looking at an emperor as a tyrant. And he's taken a classical form and applied it very nicely to a political situation in Padua. And he is making a political statement against tyranny and for the freedom of the commune. As I said, Ronald Witt has argued recently that the very first humanists were from Padua, and that he, in fact, Musato is the second generation. Finally, we have another, well, not finally, I'm just giving you a survey, but another interesting kind of humanistic look at defense of Republican liberty comes in the career of Cola di Rienzo. Right, David? He's going to be an expert on Cola in a few months. Cola di Rienzo, have you talked about him? Is that name familiar at all? Okay, I'll put his name up here.
It's in my notes somewhere.
All the Italian names are running together.
I know. If you hear them a couple times from a couple different directions, it'll start to make sense.
I know it's written down in my notes somewhere.
Cola, the son of Rienzo. And guess what? He was a notary, too. Did I tell you that Musato is a notary? And Cola's a notary, too. And because of his professional training, he had been imbued with a thorough knowledge of Roman law and with the dream of reviving the glory of ancient Rome. So while the popes were away in Avignon, power was up for grabs in Rome, and he led a popular uprising. Now, there had been a commune in Rome. There had been a popular government on and off. But they were always fighting against the control of very powerful barons who lived in and around Rome. So while the popes were in Avignon, he led a popular uprising against the barons of Rome and declared himself tribune of the people of Rome.
Oh, no,
remember him?
I remember. Now I remember.
Yeah, it depends on the sources you read. He could be out of control or he could be quite methodical. Anyway, he was initially enthusiastically championed by Petrarch, as you remember. Do you remember that? Petrarch thought he was the greatest. Now it's coming back to you. Okay. And he'd met Petrarch when he was up on a diplomatic mission to the Pope in Avignon. Petrarch was living up there. When news reached Petrarch of Cola's revolution in May of 1347, Petrarch sent Cola and the Romans a congratulatory oration. Did you share this with them, any of his oration? Okay, here's just a bit of it. There are now three named Brutus celebrated in history. The first exiled the proud Tarquin, and that's when the Roman Republic was established. The second slew Julius Caesar to save the Republic. And the third, speaking of Rienzo, has brought exile and death to the tyrants of our own age. Our third Brutus, then, equals both the others because in his own person he had united the cause of the double glory that the other two divided between them. Okay, so, you know, another touchstone, or kind of related to this idea of looking at the Republic instead of the Empire, is Brutus a bad guy or a good guy? Right? Was it good to kill Caesar, or was it bad to kill Caesar? There's a lot of debate. I think even Shakespeare's wrestling with that. Don't you think in his play Julius Caesar, he's still wrestling with that idea, and they will through the Renaissance. Was it a good thing that Caesar was killed, or was it a bad thing? What does he think? That was good. It was a good thing to kill Brutus. So that means you're a Republican. It doesn't end up so well for Brutus, though, does it? Do you remember? That's because Dante is a monarchist. Yeah, he believes in world empire. That's exactly right. Okay. at the same time, if you guys want to look at this little poem he wrote, and it's believed that it was Cola di Rienzo that he wrote this poem to. Here's another really interesting. Does anyone like to read poetry out loud? Anyone want to read that? I'll read it, okay? I don't know if I'm very good, but okay, he's speaking to Cola. That's what people think, and it makes sense to me. Noble spirit, you who govern those members within which dwells pilgrim of valorous, knowing, and wise lord, now that you have gained the honored staff wherewith you correct Rome and her erring citizens and call her back to her ancient path, I speak to you because I do not see everywhere a ray of virtue which is extinguished in the world, nor do I find anyone who is ashamed of doing ill. You said things are bad, and you're our only hope. What Italy expects or yearns for, I do not know, for she does not seem to feel her woes, being old, idle, and slow. Will she sleep forever, and will no one ever awaken her? Might I have my hand clutched in her hair? Can you get that great image? Here's an old, tired, weak woman, down on her knees. And he said, I wish I could get my hand into her hair. I do not hope that she will ever move her head from her sluggish sheep for any sleep, for any shouting one can do. She is so heavily oppressed and by such a weight. But not without destiny is our head, Rome, now entrusted to your arms, which can shake her strongly and raise her up. Put your hand into those venerable locks confidently and into those unkempt tresses, so that this neglectful one may come out of the mud. I, who day and night bewail her torment, place the greater part of my hopes in you. For if the people of Mars, who's that, the people of Mars?
The Romans,
are ever to lift up their eyes to their own honor, it seems to me that the grace will befall in your days. So what's he saying?
Now's the time.
Go for it, Cola. What are his feelings about Italy, the state of things in Italy?
They're bad.
The Italians are always, it's almost haunted, even Machiavelli, haunted by this ancient greatness that the Italians just can't quite seem to realize in their own day. And that's, I think that kind of, there's that sense of it in Petrarch. But you know, Petrarch is really an interesting figure. While city-states like Padua and Rome provided the initial context for the development of humanism, the movement's first acknowledged leader was Francesco Petrarca. Did he live in a commune? Did you guys know much about his life?
No.
He was raised in France because his father was exiled.
He lived unattached to any political community, which is kind of interesting. And the relationship of his humanism to politics was always ambivalent, despite what I just read to you. Those are kind of his big outbursts. But yes, he was born in Arezzo, in Tuscany, the son of a Florentine exile. His father, he actually wasn't from Florence, he was from the Contado, from a little village that Florence controlled. But his father was an exile. But his father was a notary, his father's father was a notary, and his father's father was a notary that lived in that area. His father, though, was an exile, and he spent his youth outside Avignon, where his father worked at the papal court. So throughout his life, I think it's pretty clear that he felt torn between the active and the contemplative life. In youth, he was drawn toward the active life and seems to have had a positive attitude toward the vita activa politica. In 1345, while in Verona, you probably know this too, he discovered Cicero's letters to Atticus, in which Cicero, remember, a very active Republican, frankly described his political ambition and the manipulative strategies he used to fulfill them. And Petrarch was aghast. Here his idol had been exposed as a slimy politician, right? He was dismayed, and he wrote two letters to Cicero criticizing him for abandoning his studies for the world. Yet, we have poem 128, written about the same time, 1344, between 1344 and 45. And here I've given you just the opening stanzas on that same handout. Let's read it and kind of, as we read, think about what's he saying here, what's his themes. My Italy, although speech does not aid those mortal wounds, of which in your lovely body I see so many, I wish at least my size to be such as Tiber and Arno hope for, and Po, where I now sit sorrowful and sad. Ruler of heaven, I beg that the mercy that made you come to earth may now make you turn to your beloved holy country. Whoa. Okay. These guys are so nationalistic, really. See, noble lord, from what trivial causes comes such cruel war. The hearts that proud, fierce Mars makes hard and closed, Father, do you open and soften and free? Cause your truth, though I am unworthy, to be heard there through my tongue. Actually, you can go on and read, but what is in this opening stanza? What is he saying? What does he feel about Italy? She's in bad shape.
And words are not going to help her.
It needs God's intervention.
It needs God's intervention. Yeah, he says the words won't help, but at the end of that first stanza, what is he suggesting?
That if God would help him to say the right words, they would help.
That he is willing to be her special spokesman. And what's he suggesting there? What power does language have?
The power to words.
Not in Latin here, but in
that's
Italian.
It's the vernacular. That's it. And he was a master of the vernacular too. But this idea that, and did you talk about this with his humanism, that words can lead to virtuous action? Right? Really important idea for the humanist. So he seems to think that perhaps he can say the right thing. But he seems here to have a political concern of some type, doesn't he? And maybe feel like he has some kind of mission. Then it's 2 years after this that he became involved with the revival of Rome's popular republic under Cola di Rienzo. He was not ambivalent, as I just said, about the connection between eloquence and virtue, and especially to act virtuously, virtue as it's lived, and the power of words to urge the hearer to moral virtue. He talks a little bit, here's just a little example from On His Own Ignorance. The true moral philosophers, and the true moral philosophers and useful teachers of the virtues are those whose first and last intention is to make the hearer and reader good. So the true moral philosophers and useful teachers of the virtues are those whose first and last intention is to make the hearer and reader good. Those who do not merely teach what virtue and vice are and hammer into our ears the brilliant name of one and the grim name of the other, but sow into our hearts love of the best and eager desire for it, and at the same time hatred of the worst and how to flee it. You don't tell people what virtue is. You make them want to be good. You inculcate them a desire. You don't teach them what evil is. You teach them to shun it and avoid evil. So it's the action, the outcome is what you're looking at. This coupling of eloquence and virtue gave humanism a very compelling rationale that transformed it into a movement. Yet, there always remained for Petrarch a tension and ambiguity in the relationship between the active and the contemplative, the worldly and the spiritual life. In another work called On the Solitary Life, he wrote, "Both the diversity of their ways of life and the wholly opposed ends for which they have worked make me believe that philosophers have always thought differently from orators. For the latter's efforts are directed toward gaining the applause of the crowd, while the former strive, if their declarations are not false, to know themselves, to return the soul to itself, and to despise empty glory." So there's an ambivalence there. Petrarch is not a product of the commune. He's drawn into the struggles in Italy. He's attracted by Cola, but he's ambivalent. Okay, did you guys talk about the ascent of Mount Ventoux in here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what happens in that interesting little piece? Do you remember? He's going to climb the highest mountain in the area.
With his brother, the
monk. And what does he want? What's his purpose for climbing that? He's going to almost maybe a sense of something will be revealed to him there as he looks across, can see into Italy from up there. But what happens?
He takes the wayward path. He tries to go the easy way, and he can't get there. So ultimately, he has to go the hard route.
And at the end of the day, when he gets to the top, what does he realize?
Yeah.
He ends in introspection and silence, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
So it's silence in the end. So he's an interesting, he's really ambivalent about this. If we look at him for a political, you know, his position on the political situation, he's not really quite ready to commit himself. He sees the power of eloquence, but he doesn't really apply it in a consistent way to politics.
Doesn't he also kind of write off Cola when he thinks Cola went too far?
Yes, he does.
Okay.
Actually, the papacy kind of withdraws. The papacy was behind him to some extent, and they withdraw support. Yeah, and he does get a little erratic, and yeah, the thing fails. But I think what's happening is the papacy is trying to balance off Cola and the barons and keep them both in control. And the papacy does eventually withdraw their support when Cola starts sounding a little too Republican. So anyway, yes. So now let's talk about humanism in Florence, and then we'll have a break. Okay, you guys still awake? Any questions? All right. Petrarch's novel approach to the past found an early and a receptive audience in Florence, where a group of Petrarch's admirers had begun to meet to discuss and study ancient Latin literature. Now, by this time, by the early 14th century, most of these communes had passed away. They were overcome with the expensive war, a lot of them, and they were never able to really resolve the internal political conflicts. They were unstable, and so they kind of fall apart. But by the time, by the early 14th century, there are about 8 important cities left where republicanism survived. Florence is one of them, where it survived beyond the early 14th century. Florence, Genoa, Bologna, Lucca, Siena, Perugia, and Rome. Just remember Florence is and probably one of the largest. Venice, did I say Venice? Venice is kind of an artifact. Venice is a republic, but a very closed oligarchy, in fact. It's kind of a facade of a republic. But they're the longest lasting republic, the very last one to go. Yes, but it's kind of a fossil. There's not a broad representative government in Florence. It's pretty much a closed oligarchy. But anyway, so that's what we have. From the late Trecento through at least the mid-Quattrocento, Florence is the city, the center of humanistic activity in Italy. Why Florence? Why would it be in Florence? Any ideas?
If you ask Bernie, it's because it's the best possible place on earth.
If you ask who? Oh, Bernie. Because it's perfect, right? Well, because Florence doesn't have a university. Now, that would seem like a negative, wouldn't it? Why would that be a positive? Who's in control of those universities? Who are the teachers?
Students.
They're scholastics, right? The very people who Petrarch is attacking in on his own ignorance, right? The guys that are just logic, dialectic, dry, infertile knowledge, just knowledge that doesn't really make you morally better. Okay, so there's no university in Florence, thus no strong scholastic tradition to oppose humanistic ideas. There's a market for humanism in Florence, right? You've got a very strong economy, a vibrant middle class. You have literate and wealthy Florentine elite, especially the elite. They begin hiring humanists to educate their children. So there's work in Florence. And then when they're off work, they go and sit around and do humanism together. Okay, so there's a market, and there's no competition from the scholastics. Okay? And you know what? Florence is interesting. There's an incredible degree of literacy, even among non-elites. And I didn't bring all the statistics because it really is interesting. But we have the guild community. We have the upper kind of the members of the greater guilds are participating in government. And actually, by the time, right before Bruni comes on the scene, it's very broad, and even the lower guilds are involved. But in the guild community, we have a remarkable degree of literacy. There's a famous chronicler named Giovanni Villani. He was a chronicler of the 1330s, and he gives some statistics that suggest, if you kind of work them through, that about 68% of boys and girls in Florence attended school. That's a lot. 68% of the children, boys and girls, attended school. And actually, this does square with the fact that a century later, they did a survey so they'd know how much they could tax the people of Florence. And 80% of the households' heads in Florence submitted their fiscal declarations in their own handwriting. That's a pretty high percentage. People filled out their own fiscal declarations. So it kind of reinforces the idea that we have a high literacy rate. So that's why humanism took off in Florence. Those three reasons. There may be others, but I think those are three pretty compelling reasons. Now, a close relationship between humanism and Florentine politics developed especially after 1375, when a humanist became chancellor of the Republic. Do you guys know what a chancellor is? What does a chancellor do? He writes letters. But who cares about writing letters? He is a diplomat. He is the official spokesperson for the city. In that capacity, yes, he can be a diplomatic missionary. He could sit on governmental discussions and debates. But he is kind of the official communicator for Florence. And his name is Coluccio Salutati. You heard about him?
Yes.
A lot?
Yes.
Okay.
There's probably a lot more that we haven't heard.
Well, I'd like to know what you know. What do you know about him?
His father was a Guelph.
Guelph?
Guelph. He ended up in exile.
He was do you know what a Guelph is, you guys?
You can remind me. I can't remember.
I do.
Tell him, David. This might be on the midterm.
Part of the, that's the side of the papal. The papal, what do you call it?
The papal party, I guess.
Party versus the Ghibellines, or the emperor.
Imperial. Party. Remember, the communes are kind of in a papal-imperial sandwich, right? They're right in between the empire on top, the papacy on the bottom. Supporters of the emperor are Ghibellines, and supporters of the papacy are Guelphs. Just remember.
But there was also two different kinds of Guelphs, right?
They were black and white Guelphs. Yeah. You read about that in The Life of Dante, didn't you?
Well, that was one of the times I read about it. Yeah. We've read about it a couple of other times,
okay.
too.
Yeah, and Dante was a white Guelph.
Right.
So he was an exile. A white Guelph who is pro-imperial. I'll tell you why. How can you be a Guelph and a monarchist? Because if you're Florentine, you're Guelph, period. Okay, these cities kind of line themselves up traditionally on one side or the other, and often Florence was on the side of the papacy. But at that point, the people who really liked the papacy were the black Guelphs, and the ones who really liked the emperor were the white Guelphs. But that doesn't make sense, does it? It's politics. It's very
convoluted.
And the debate is about 15 minutes into the debate. You know what? I'm so sick. I don't even want to watch them anymore, do you?
It's
like running for high school, like class president. No, you don't get any facts. It's just all
rhetoric.
Yeah, it is. Anyway.
It's not even good rhetoric.
It's just, it's depressing. Anyway, we'll read some good, like I said, we'll read some good spin tonight. So Coluccio Salutati, self-made man. He was born in Arezzo. He spent 20 years in Bologna, and in Bologna had a big university. Do you know what it was? What they study in Bologna? Law. Great place to study law. The place to study law. He studied law and became a notary. And in 1374, he received an appointment as a notary in the Office of Elections in Florence, and a year later he became a chancellor. And he held that position for 31 years until he died. Salutati's interesting because he's a humanist, so he really knows, he's really into Latin literature and history. He begins to use the Latin literary tradition and ancient Roman history in new ways to justify Florentine policy. Okay, he is a spokesperson. He is trying to encourage the allies to hang tough against their enemies. He's trying to defame the enemies to everyone else in the world. He's trying to justify what Florence is doing. So he is a PR man. And he begins to use the Latin literary tradition, Roman history, to justify the Florentine policy and politics. And he appealed especially to the new men and the patrician allies who ruled Florence. What's interesting is that Florence had a problem. About the time he became chancellor, Florence was at war with its traditional ally, the papacy. So Salutati couldn't use the traditional Guelph arguments. Usually Florence, one of his arguments for freedom and liberty is we stand with the church, we're united with the church, and we want liberty. That's a Guelph argument. He couldn't use that, though, because they were fighting the papacy. So he began to emphasize instead Florence's origins as a colony of the Roman Republic and emphasize its mission to defend republican liberty in the face of a tyrannical papal monarchy. He can't use the old stuff, the Guelph stuff, so he has to turn to something new, and he begins to use Roman history. He attacked, this is between 1375 and 8, when they were at war with the papacy, he attacked the institution of monarchy as being inherently bad. And he emphasized that the distinction between the two governments, monarchy and republicanism, were that liberty teaches virtue. So under a republican or free government, one can become virtuous. He also argued that guildsmen naturally loved liberty and peace and equality and were thus able to fill public positions and made the best kind of citizens. That sounds like civic humanism to me. The problem is Salutati was not consistent in presenting this republican view. After the immediate crisis with the papacy had passed, Salutati returned to his loyalty to an imperial structure. He was more comfortable there. And in 1400, he wrote a tract called the De Tyranno, 6 years before his death, and he defended Caesar. So that means you're not really a Republican if you think that Brutus made a mistake. And he condemned Caesar's Republican executioners. So we don't really have an ideologue here, do we? He's dabbling in the ideas when it suits his subject, but we don't have a political philosopher here. He was, however, a brilliant propagandist. During the war with the Visconti about 15 years later, he rallied the people of Florence to the city's defense while he engaged in diplomatic maneuverings designed to frustrate Milan's machinations. The letters, again, returned to the traditional theme of Guelph versus Ghibelline. He went back to the old medieval arguments to the almost complete exclusion of the earlier, more classically inspired ideas. But Gian Galeazzo Visconti was credited with saying 1,000 Florentine horsemen did him less damage than the letters of Coluccio Salutati. He was very effective. In fact, he sent assassins to kill Salutati, but they were unable to do it. When that failed, he arranged for a forged letter implicating Salutati in treason to be delivered to the come into possession of the council. But Salutati was able to persuade the council that the letter was forged and that he was not a traitor. But in addition to his duties as chancellor, at this time, Salutati became the informal leader of a widening circle of humanists that included the future chancellors, Leonardo Bruni and Poggio Bracciolini. And together, these humanists would edit and translate classical texts. They would imitate classical styles and genres. They would argue that Latin grammar, ancient history, and the reading of ancient authors from Plato to the Church Fathers provided a better moral education than did any scholastic, didactic, dialectic, and philosophy. So let's take a break, shall we? And we'll come back and look at Bruni and his republicanism.